So welcome to another exciting episode of the Good Listening To Show. Before we get underway, just to let you know, this is actually part two of the wonderful episode of Mike Fenton Stevens, who runs his own podcast called My Time Capsule. So listen to part one first if you'd like to, but if that's the way you roll, you want to go straight into episode two, you're very welcome to be here. But yes, do listen to part one. I would first. Here we go. Let's get going. Mike Fenton Stevens in the clearing. And we're off. Welcome to another episode of the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes, the storytelling show that features The Clearing, where all good questions come to get asked and all good stories come to be told. And where all my guests have two things in common. They're all creative individuals and all with an interesting story to tell. There are some lovely storytelling metaphors. A clearing, a tree, a juicy storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1, some alchemy, some gold, a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, and a cake. So it's all to play for. So yes, welcome to the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we shall begin. So, ladies and gentlemen, min, please welcome back Mike Fenton Stevens. This is part two of the Good Listening To Show with the fifth groin along on the beach of Cuden Beach Hotel for his clearing. We're now in the canopy of the trees, continuing his Good Listening To. Here we go. Wonderful. This is inspiring and shaping. So this is wonderful. So where would you like to go in the canopy of your trees?
Well, I obviously, as I said, I have to go straight to my dad, which he, having done that thing of trying to be a stand-up comedian, he then became a solicitor and was very successful, had an amazing career.
Yeah.
And spent his whole time in in criminal law, defending people, always defended people, defended Christine Keeler in her libel charges. But that's really the minor side of it. He massive murder cases and armed robberies and terrible, terrible crimes he dealt with all the time with these extraordinary people. And he was really, really good at it. And but every weekend, my dad would take the bug of wanting to be on stage. And he formed his own old-time musical group.
Wow.
Of people he'd found, like-minded people, and they would do shows every weekend. Almost every Saturday night was spent him standing on stage singing old-time musical songs and doing Al Jolson and things like that. And from about the age of nine, I was always showed that I was interested in it. Mm. And he dragged me along and said, well, come and sing a song, son. And So I would sing sweet songs in my little soprano voice, and of course people adored me, little boy standing up there singing Bless This House, you know. Yeah. And then after my voice broke, I continued to sing almost very quickly. People say you should take a gap between your voice breaking and then starting to sing again. But I sort of sang through it. And I think maybe one of the reasons that I have a large range is that I kept singing. I've learned to sing because I needed to. It was that sort of thing, you know. Which we don't really do as in our culture. We sort of get to the age of there and your voice breaks and people say, well, I can't sing now. You get embarrassed because you've got that half break point. But, I was back on stage very quickly singing the songs of my father, you know, nearly every song that had the word father in it. So, you know, Following Father's Footsteps, Father Papered the Parlor. He would say, here's my son. And I'd stand up and sing this song. And so
what's so lovely as well is that my great sort of all-time comic hero, Stan Laurel, and you're in great company because of Stanley Jefferson's dad was in Variety as well.
Yeah.
So it's profound that your own dad was, even though he became a lawyer, a frustrated actor, but presumably he loved his path in the end.
He was a very good performer as well, my dad. Yes. And that's not just rose-tinted spectacles. I have recordings of him, and I always suspected that I rather look back on it with rose-tinted spectacles, and then I've listened to the recordings more recently and gone, bloody hell, he's good. And you know, from an outside, a professional point of view, I can listen to it and go, wow, his timing is great.
Yes.
And he sings really well. And he's got complete control over the audience. I mean, really, he was really, really good. I think he always regretted that he hadn't been the direction he went in. So that when I eventually said, I'm not going to do the law, I know I've done 3 years and you give me lots of money to have a nice time, but I'm not going to take up the position that you've arranged for me through your influences. I'm going to go off and we're going to tour around in a VW camper and do shows, you know. And he went, oh no, he immediately said, oh, that sounds like fun.
Vicarious joy. Yes, sir. Mm. Fly, go. Love yeah. that. Is he still with us, I'm assuming?
No, he died in 1999. Wow. Just astonishing, a long time ago. It's yes. amazing when you think back like that, the speed with which people, the distance occurs is really disturbing. You know. Yeah, so
my daughter was born in 1999 and that sorted out what to do on the Millennium New Year's Eve. So
yes.
So we're still in the canopy. I'm loving this, by the way. So
okay. I'm going to be very predictable, really, and just say my mum as well. You know, now strangely, my mother was a complete opposite of my dad. She was a person who had a fear of people standing up and doing things in case it was embarrassing. Without a doubt, I can't remember a time when my dad, at any party or any occasion, would just jump up and say, "Come on, let's sing a song," and off he'd go. And my mum would go, "Oh, Harry." And he'd go, "No, shush, and off he'd go. And then people would have a whale of a time. She would have a few drinks and have a good time. But her main setting was be careful, stand back,
yes.
be cautious. And I think it's having those two things to look at that, in fact, made me realise that what my dad was doing, in a way, you know, it wasn't just something that came to me through him. And I realised that there was a risk involved in it. But actually, that the risk is worth it.
Yes.
You know, just recently, I had a conversation with my wife where she said I was talking about embarrassment, people being embarrassed, and she said, "Well, that's not a problem you've ever had." And I said, "No, I've done lots of things that I know are embarrassing. Just I'm not embarrassed by it."
Yes.
And the reason, I mean, I know I've been embarrassing. I can cite you lots of occasions where I've done things and looked at the whole room and gone, "Yeah, that was embarrassing, wasn't it?" But I'm not embarrassed.
Yes.
I'm not embarrassed by it. And the reason I'm not embarrassed by it is because of my dad and because my mum made it very clear to me that it never did her any good being embarrassed.
Yes.
It was no use. Again, it was that thing of losing your temper. It never helped.
Yes.
It doesn't help. And in fact, what it does is it stops you taking the risk that will mean that you do something fantastic.
Yes.
You know, I mean, brilliant.
Construct of three concentric circles of comfort, risk, panic.
Yeah.
And if you're too busy trying to be comfortable all the time, you'll never risk anything. Nobody wants
Absolutely.
Anyone to panic, but it's just a really nice way to.
And therefore, you never get into that circle, which is, you know, the joy of making people laugh or having a whole room have fun. You know?
Yes.
It's always worth it. I think it's always worth if your intention is to make life better for people.
Yes.
I think it's always worth the risk. It's always worth standing at a bus stop with somebody else on a cold, wintry morning and going, "Morning."
Oh, your intention to make somebody else's life better. I suspect that may be coming in terms of what your legacy will all be about.
I'm not sure.
So
well, I suppose, but only in a simple way. But, you know, but I think that thing of broaching conversation, of waving and smiling at people, saying hello.
Yep. Yep.
In the street, people you don't know. My wife says, "Who's that?" I say, "I don't know."
Yes, I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, I just said hello.
I just made their life better.
Because you're weird. You're a weird man. I say, "I am." Well, all right, then I'm weird. I don't care. I would rather that because, you know, as a result of that, I've got connections. I live in Tunbridge Wells. I've got connections in Tunbridge Wells with people who have no real connection with at all.
Yes.
But I know them. I've spoken to them on many occasions and they just are people I pass in the street. And
yes.
now I pass in the street and they're friends that I pass in the street. And that yes. would never have happened without the intention of, come on, let's go out there, let's do something.
Yes.
So
I met somebody yesterday who during the pandemic was walking around a particular lake in Yorkshire and apparently that's where Stephen Fry had gone. And they walked past each other so often that eventually it thawed out and then there was morning. And then they sort of knew but didn't know each other, but there was just
yes.
a lovely exchange eventually.
Yeah. I mean, and that would be the circumstances creating that. But I would have said hello the first time I saw him.
Yes.
If I didn't know him. I would have gone, "Oh, hello. How lovely."
I'm very like-minded. I found myself standing accidentally next to Sting recently and just turned to him and went, "Oh, it's Sting." I said, "Can I shake you by the hand?" So I just said hello, but it was just at that point of it
yeah.
being a bit awkward because we shouldn't be shaking hands again yet after the pandemic. So I feel very like-minded in that regard.
Yes. So they're, in a way, they're the people that will shape me, I think, you know.
Yes.
Yes. Otherwise, if I don't move on, I'm gonna be talking till the cows come home. So there we are. That's they would be the four things: my dad, my mum, going to university, and my wonderful wife.
And your mum, is she no longer with
us? Yeah, she's my mother. My mother died very suddenly. She was asked to move her car by somebody on a dust cart, and and she said, I can't, I don't know, I can't, it's too small a space, I can't back into there. And the man said, I'll do it. When it went to trial, he said he hadn't got in the car, but my mother got out of the car. The car then, for some reason, sped backwards and knocked her over, and she hit her head and died.
Good grief.
So it's a tragic story. And it is the only, and I try in all things in life, again, this would be the influence of my wife, to try and take something positive from something. And the positive from it, well, there are several positives, actually, even though most of it is rather tragic. Because, in fact, just recently, my younger brother put on Instagram or something, you know, it would have been my mother's 96th birthday, and I have no doubt that if, but for the foolishness of one man, she'd still be with us. And I think that's probably true. She was very hardy, my mother. She's rather like the Queen. She would have hung around a long time. But there we are. She also would not have enjoyed being old. She would not have enjoyed becoming incapable. So that's a blessing. And also it was quick. And most of us, sadly, are, you know, not headed that way. And we all have to be aware that at some point in our life, we almost certainly will go through a period of pain before we die. You know, and actually, again, take the positive. If you know that's coming, make the most of it. Make the most of the fact that it's not today.
Carpe diem, absolutely.
Absolutely, yes.
And what year was that?
I've driven it out of my mind. I tend to drive things like that out of my mind as a sort of a self-protection thing. I put things away things I don't like, I try not to contemplate them.
The station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer. Part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We shall move on in that case.
So, thank you.
Three things that have inspired you, and if there's any resonance, then that's really obvious, but that's fine. So three.
Yes,
things.
I mean, in a way, sort of, it the whole of this thing is sort of, I'm very family led, I'm very family orientated. So my son has inspired me, because my son had a very tough time, rather like my grandson and granddaughter are having at the moment. He dropped out of school when he was 11, because he went to a secondary school which he just didn't fit into. And although we've never really gone into it, I suspect there was quite a lot of bullying going on. And he just, his confidence collapsed. He couldn't do it. And he had a really, really difficult time. There were periods where we feared for his life. You know, we felt that he was so depressed. It was very difficult for us. My wife stopped working as a research scientist and came home and homeschooled for about 4 years. But he found the courage somewhere to get back in and to go back and do these things, even though it was incredibly difficult for him. He did that, and he's now the most lovely man. And we work together on the podcast, which I'm delighted to say we do that. So I see him most days, and I talk to him almost every day.
Oh, he's your producer?
He's my producer, yes. And he's very good at it. He does most of the work, and he's extremely good at it. And he's also a great advisor. He's very good at telling me, less of that, shut up, more of this. Which is, you know, I need that. As I say, I unfortunately don't have that switch. Well, fortunately, I think, but most people think unfortunately don't have that switch that says that's a bit embarrassing. So I tend to go down routes that other people wouldn't. Or I'm happy to talk about things that other people wouldn't be necessarily.
Also, I really enjoyed the fact, the moment when you said, I parked that, I don't want to talk about that. You're really clear, I think, also in when to say no to something, which is the world of yes and. We've got to get good at saying yes to things, but we've also got to be good and discerning about what to say no to as well.
Yeah, yeah. And no, that may be few things, but they are the things. And I think that's self-preservation as well.
Yes, you know? Absolutely.
I mean, I don't want to talk about those things because I don't want to remember it that way. I don't. That's not the thing I want to remember. I remember my mother very fondly, and I remember lots of great times with her. And that's what I'd rather remember. I don't think of my mother as this woman being knocked down and dying.
Of course.
I think of her as someone else, which is, deliberately so. Mm-hmm. Yes. So my son would certainly be the person that would be one of the people that inspire me. Strange enough, the other person that inspired me is the actor Robert Donat, who you may know, but it's a long, long time ago. I remember talking to my dad. Now, my dad was rather a chameleon man. He was able to be very posh when he was talking to the barristers that he was working with, and he would turn away from them. And I worked with him for a year before I went to university and watched him do it time and time again. He would be saying, "I know, absolutely. Well, perhaps we can have a word with the judge." Yes. And then he turned to the person next to him and say, "So what he's saying is, he wants you to, you know, behave yourself, all right?"
Wow, great leveller, fantastic.
And he just would just become,
yeah,
wherever who he was talking to, he would just become that person.
Yes.
As it were. But not out of any sort of means of deceiving them, just to make them feel comfortable. Make them feel that, you know, understand him in a way. So I remember watching him do that, and I said to him, I said, "I've got to do." I did my first Shakespeare play in a garden production at the end of my first year in Oxford. Really lovely. It meant I stayed up in Oxford during the summer. I was able to sign on. Isn't that extraordinary?
Yes.
I know. Not only did they give me a grant, but then I could sign on in the summer. So I had an income from the signing on, and I did As You Like It. I played Orlando. And I was being tutored by the director was a woman, a girl called Edia Monzi, and her mother was an actress called Yvonne Mitchell, which I don't think anybody remembers now, but she was at one time a very leading actress, RSC and all that sort of thing, with Peter O'Toole and Burton and all sorts of people. But then she stopped when she had a child, like a lot of women did. She stopped acting. Anyway, she came along to tutor me in how to speak Shakespeare, which, considering she had been one of the great Shakespearean actresses of her time, was quite a privilege. And I remember before this thing saying, my dad saying, I was talking to my dad on the phone and saying, "This Yvonne Mitchell's coming on." And he went, "Oh my God, you don't know what you've got there, Mike. She was just the most amazing actress." Yeah. I said, "Okay." I said, "Dad, I'm a bit worried because I'm not sure that I'm speaking it properly. I think I still sound like I come from Orpington." And he went, "If you get a chance, watch a Robert Donat film and just copy him." He said, "That's what I did." So in fact,
wow.
When I played, I watched it. I went, "Oh," and I remember thinking, "Okay, I'm going to deliberately try and talk like that." And that whole summer was quite an effort because I was in a way pretending to be someone else the whole time. And by the end of the summer, I had this voice. I'd learnt to speak this way. Uh-huh. But at the beginning of the summer, I still talked like I came from Orpington. And I couldn't hear myself doing it, but I knew I did. And by the end, I could hear the way that I spoke, and I taught myself to speak properly. But by listening to Robert Donat, that was
great influence. So the actor is born through the lens of listening one summer.
Yes. I mean, I think by the end of that summer, I became 139 steps. I became absolutely ridiculously sort of over the top and rather sort of World War One than World War Two. Come on, chaps. You know, but that was by how I developed.
And accent convergence, by the way, if you move around a lot in one's life, is a way of blending in order to survive, isn't it? So
yes.
In my world, I morphed and got characters in that way. But that's very, very relatable.
Absolutely. At Oxford, it meant that suddenly I was accepted in all groups. I could go from, you know, and I could actually go to people's rooms and have butlers and things. It was ridiculous. Anyway. Yeah, so that would be the second thing, and a third thing would be the actor Anthony Quayle, which is rather lovely, but for a completely different reason. I was doing my very first professional play at Colchester, and Anthony Quayle had come to see, but we didn't know it was him actually. One of the actresses in it said, "I've got someone important today watching me. Can you all please, you know, your best, be good, make me look good," and we did. And it was the final matinee, and I think people were going to mess around, and we all agreed that we would do a good show in order for her to get this part that he was coming to see her for. And after the show, there was a knock on my dressing room door, and Tony Quayle popped his head round. Now, anybody who doesn't know him, he sort of started the Royal Shakespeare Company before Peter Hall, and he was a great film actor and stage actor, worked with all the greats, Olivier, and he was a brilliant, brilliant actor and a wonderful, wonderful man. But he put his head around the door and said, hello, I'm Tony Quayle. And I said, I know who you are. And he went, oh, right, would you like to join my company?
Wow.
Just like that. Yes. And I said, yes, please. And he said, good, okay. This is my telephone number. Ring me when you're finished here, and I'll give you the details. And I said, do I audition? He said, no, you've just auditioned and you got in. And that was it. And I worked with him for quite a number of years, on and off. But we also became really steadfast friends.
Yes.
You say friends, he was like a mentor, really, rather. I mean, I always admired him too much for him to be just a friend. He was incredibly wise and thoughtful man, and he gave me life lessons just quietly. We toured quite a lot, and he would take me out to lunch. He would, once a week, we'd go and have lunch in a pub, and we would just talk about everything, about his career, about all the things he'd done, about his family. And he very, very slowly and very carefully, without it ever becoming a lecture, just gave me clues, I think, as to how to be happy in life, what was really important. He always said, I think there was a period where I was on tour and there was a girl who was chasing me, actually, I have to say, which I know sounds a bit boastful, but it wasn't. She was making it very clear that she was interested in me, another actress, and she was very beautiful. And he had spotted this. And so he told me, he said to me, you know, I mean, I think about it, when I think back over my life, he said, if I put things in order, I would say, you know, down the list, third probably comes acting and my acting career and all the films and things. He said, I've had a fabulous time, but that's well down the list of the most important things. He said, you know, second would be the war, what I did in the war. I was in the Secret Service and we did some extraordinary things. And he said, I'm very proud of it. And it was very tough, but I'm very proud of what I did. And I hope I contributed to the success that we had. He said, but first, without a doubt, way beyond any of those would be my family life and my wife and my children. He said, they're absolutely been the rock on which my life has been built. And they are the most important thing. He said, and I wouldn't risk them for anything.
And
I went, right.
Yes.
And he said, you know what I'm saying, don't you? And I went, I do know what you're saying. And don't worry. He went, good. Good boy. But he'd just seen that there was a point. He'd seen it too many times. I think it does happen. And he was just saying, don't do it.
Yes.
Just don't do it. Yes. And I wasn't going to do it. But the advice has stuck with me and made me realize, you know, just how important those things are.
the destruction by dalliance, almost. Yes.
Yeah, the stupidity of it. Yes. No, absolutely not. No.
And I remember him really, really well, his face, Anthony Quayle. And am I right in assuming he was in Ice Cold in Alex as well?
He was indeed, yes.
That's,
he was
that's in... the film I really remember.
And Guns of Navarone.
Yes.
The Guns of Navarone, great film.
And the opportunity that he afforded you by saying, do you want to join? Was that the RSC? Well, what was that?
No, he had a company called Compass, and his intention was for it to be a company that did sort of great plays. We started off doing some a silly little farce because that's all he could get the funding for. And yes. It was great fun, brilliant fun. And then, you know, we did The Tempest, we did St. Joan, Bernard Shaw, a number of other things over the years. And just, I loved him. I loved him. I still love him to this day. He was a brilliant, brilliant man. And without a doubt, he's probably been... And even more inspirational to me than my own father, which is extraordinary. Yeah. So there we are. That's the three.
And now we're going to talk about two things that never fail to grab your attention. This is the, oh, squirrels, you know, what two things in your life never fail to be your monsters of distraction?
Well, I will say children, and not just my own children and my own grandchildren, but children generally. And I believe that they have that right.
Yes.
They should grab your attention. I'm always disappointed in people whose attention is not grabbed by children. That when a child walks to a table and you're all talking and somebody's in the middle of an anecdote and a child says, Mummy, that they go, shh, shh, darling, just a moment. Now, I know that children have to learn that there is a time and a place and all those sort of things. But generally, when a child comes to you, the thing that they're concerned about is so much more important and so much more immediate than this anecdote that you've told before, or this joke you're in the middle of, you have the ability to pick it up. And I really think that we should go, yes, yes, darling, what is it? Because you never know. They might be saying, Peter's on the roof.
Yes, and he is. Yes,
exactly. And he is. And you, and you just go, oh, okay, thank you. I'm just going to go, my child seems to be on the roof. You know, I mean, that's a possibility, isn't it? Far more likely that they'll approach you in that sort of gentle way. We would run and say, Peter's on the roof! But a child necessarily knows that they've been told lots of times, don't interrupt. And so they might be being polite. And I just feel that actually children saying things to you is more important than an adult saying something to you. That we should give it more attention.
Children are the best squirrels, absolutely.
Mm. So I would definitely say there. And the other thing, which is, so I was born in 1958. I was born 2 weeks after the Munich air disaster that saw the death of most of the Manchester United players. And we lived in Bermondsey, right near Millwall Football Ground. But my father insisted that I was a Manchester United fan. And so it would be Manchester United. That I can't resist whenever I see anything about it, or, you know, and I've had the most fantastic experiences with Manchester United. I'm extremely lucky to have supported that club. You know, as you can imagine, 1999 Barcelona, one of the greatest moments of my life. It was just a joyous thing. You know, I generally approach almost every Manchester United game with the idea that they're going to lose, because my experience for most of my life when I was younger was that they did.
Yes.
They would get so far, but not far enough. That's my memory of Manchester United. So the last sort of 15 years, has been glorious.
Yes.
I just can't believe it's actually happened. It was fantastic. But I've had wonderful things. I've been to Manchester United a number of times. I've been to watch them play. I was relating to somebody just the other day that I once stood in the toilets of the director's box. So the director's toilets, not just the toilets in the director's box, but the actual toilets that were only the directors were supposed to use. And a director had said to me, oh, it's all right, you can use those. And I went into this toilet and I stood there, and then somebody came in and stood next to me, and it was Bobby Charlton. And the idea that standing next to someone at a urinal is one of the great moments of your life, but it was.
Yes.
He even said to me, all right, son. And I said, I'm great, thanks, Bobby.
Lovely.
I really was great. This is one of the great moments of my life.
The most satisfying wee of your entire life.
Indeed, without a doubt. You know, fantastic. You know, yeah. So Manchester United always grabs my attention.
And I hope sincerely you get David Beckham on my time capsule at some point.
Wouldn't that be interesting? I mean, I've never had a footballer. I've not had a footballer. I've had a number of sports people, and I really enjoy talking to them because they have such a lovely passion.
Yes.
You know, particularly for the things that they've done. And of course, most of them have memories that we mere mortals will never come close to.
Yes.
I spoke to David Gower and
yes, I remember.
But he said, it's a wonderful thing. He doesn't think about it often. It's not a thing. He wakes up thinking, I'm the man who won the Ashes, was the captain of the England team that won the Ashes.
Yeah.
He doesn't think about it. He said, gets on with life, as we all do. But every now and again, when he's feeling really down, and he says, everybody feels down at some point, he's able to say, well, at least I did that.
Yes.
Mm.
Keep perspective in the highs, the lows, the lows.
Yeah,
the
quite.
The
lovely.
Bad times.
Yeah.
Lovely journeyman story.
Mm.
And now we're going to talk about a quirky or unusual fact about you we couldn't possibly know until you've told us.
Right. I was trying to think what this was, and I think I do, but not always. It's not always true. But when I talk to my grandchildren about anything, I think in rhyme. I rhyme things all the time. I just can't. I can't help it. I see rhymes in everything. Maybe I should have been a lyricist, but I love rhymes, and so do children.
Rhymes with grimes.
I very rarely talk to them without actually either turning it into a song. Or, they would just say, sing a song, Grandad, and I, on the spot, will sing a song.
But not a song
that they know, just a new one. I just say, well, we're going down the shops, it'll be enormous fun. We're going to come along, why don't you all come? Because down the shops is a great big house. Unfortunately, it's got an enormous mouse. And it's rubbish. It's absolute gibberish, but I do it all the time.
Thank you for making that up right now, proving you can do it. That's
awesome. Not great. It wasn't a great rhyme, but I do. That's what I do. And I just will go down. Generally, I'll make sure that it always ends with, and that's what we will do. And after that, I'll probably have a great big poo. And children love that.
My kind of grandfather, absolutely right there.
In with we and poo. They're the ones, and that always finishes the song nicely.
They're my factory default settings. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Love that.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer, life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We have shaken your tree. And there's more to come, which may be...
Oh, my word.
So now we're still in the clearing, which is your fifth groin along. We've shaken the illustrious canopy of your tree with some wonderful, delicious content. And now we'll get a bit of a look on. We're going to talk about alchemy and gold now. When you are at purpose and in flow, Mike Fenton-Stevens, what are you absolutely happiest doing in what you're here to reveal to the world?
Well, I was going to say nothing. I quite like doing nothing. But that's because I'm sort of thinking. I suppose that's reminiscing. And I quite like reminiscing. I like just thinking about things that have happened. And it makes me very happy. But I would say walking. I love walking. I feel very content walking. I'm doing the million steps challenge. And you know, which is for diabetes at the moment. It's not the most grueling thing in the world because it's designed for anybody to be able to do. But it's nice to have a challenge. And in fact, I'm on 979,000 steps. So within the next day or maybe two, I will have completed my million step challenge.
Congratulations, by the way. I'm so happy I've captured you just before the last triumphant steps.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm asking, is that a personal connection to diabetes? Is that why you're doing
it? This was what's going to come out of when you ask me, I suppose, which is the next thing, when you're going to offer me some cake. And I'm going to say, well, I can't eat it, I'm afraid. Because I was diagnosed with diabetes just before Christmas. Type 2 diabetes, which is usually as a result of diet and lifestyle. And clearly, mine was too much sugar. I mean, I'm not an obese person. I'm not overweight, particularly. I'm a little bit overweight. But I, particularly during lockdown, got into the habit of pretending that I was an actor coming off stage, and at 10 o'clock at night, I'd say, I quite fancy a drink, as we do, we actors. Yes. We'll have a drink in the pub before we go home. Unfortunately, I was already home, which meant that I would be polishing off a bottle of wine. And that became a bit of a habit. And as a result, I rather stupidly pushed myself into this situation. So I would advise people, if you think that's what's happening to you, do something about it. And I have done something about it. And I'm glad to say I'm in remission, which is delightful. Only sort of 6 months afterwards, I was able to change my diet, change my way of life, stop drinking. Certainly restrict the amount of drinking I was having, and change what I ate. And I'm fine. But as a result, I decided to do this walking and raise money for diabetes. Yeah.
And congratulations that you're nearly there. And it's very relatable because I myself have, my sugar levels are nearly always on that ceiling.
Right.
So I've dieted out, but pandemic, lockdown, I'm oscillating. So I'm still in remission, but I'm beginning to feel I probably need a test again. So that's very timely.
Right.
So congratulations to you. Also, by the way, one of my breakthroughs with this show is that it also comes into the UK health radio space. So the fact that you're talking about diabetes is of interest as well.
Yes. I mean, the fact that it's not, you might say, if you show me a group of people, I'd probably be able to spot the people with diabetes. That isn't the case at all. I mean, you and I, we both don't look like people who would be suffering from these things, but we are. And as a result, and that's really, and it's very easy to avoid it. It's very easy in life to know the truth of health, I think. I was a smoker for a long time when younger, and as I talk about abuse of the voice, a ridiculous thing to do as an actor, really. But a lot of actors, when I joined, said, "Oh, no good. It will give you gravity, a certain element of and it has. But at the same time, I wish it hadn't.
Yes. So thank you for that fact too. And yes, so now I'm going to award you with your cake.
Lovely.
We stumbled into that. So you're going to reject
I'll give it to my grandchildren. I'll give it to the grandchildren.
Wonderful. So you'll take the cake, but gift it on. I like you. That's lovely. So now we put a cherry on your cake, which is the final series of storytelling metaphors, which is what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given? What notes, help or advice might you offer to a younger version of yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Favourite quote you might like? And then we're going to get into Shakespeare.
In a way, the best piece of advice would be also the advice I would give to somebody who was young. So they really come together, which is when I decided I want to be an actor, and I said to my dad, I'm going to be an actor, Dad. And he said, right. So do you know how you're going to do that? And at the time I didn't. And he said, well, you'll need to get an equity card, won't you? And I said, yes. So he said, right, okay. My advice is be bold. Be as bold as you like, because nobody will. People who think you're being too bold will forget it. They don't know who you are. They'll forget that you've ever done it. But the people who are impressed by it will remember you forever. And I said, what do I do then? He said, well, write a letter and send it to everybody. Everybody you can find the address of who has any influence in the world of theatre and the world of acting, and tell them that you are an extremely good young actor who will be doing great things throughout his career. And all you need is an equity card. And if they are the person who is fortunate enough to provide you with that card, they will be able to tell people in the future that they were the person that gave you the break. And I said, they're going to screw that up. And he said, they won't all do that. Somebody will go, cheeky sod. He said, and that's be bold. So I did. And Bill Kenwright phoned me up and said, you're a cheeky sod. And I said, yeah, well, my dad told me to. He said, I like your dad. I like the sound of your dad. Come to London. I'll see what I can do. And I went up to London, had lunch with him. We had a fantastic time. We got very drunk. I didn't know the man at all. He was a massive impresario at the time, and I was a student. We had a great time. He said to me, well, you know, he said, I think you're right, son. I think you probably will have a good career. I think you look like you're going to be doing fine. He said, but you need help, don't you? I said, yeah. He said, okay, well, leave it with me. About 2 weeks later, when I'd finished my course, he offered me a job as an ASM, which came with a card. And it was only a month's work, and I got my card, and that was it. I've never worked for Bill Kenwright ever since, strangely enough, but I've always held him in great affection for it. And I hope that occasionally at a dinner party, if somebody ever talks about something that they've seen me do or mentions me, you never know, he says, yeah, I gave that kid his first break.
Cheeky sob, but leave it with me. 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
It's a good one. Love that. And in fact, you should
be bold
on your My Time Capsule as well, because that is a wonderful connection to pay it forward, pay it back, and say thank you.
Yes. So that's lovely. So that would be the advice I would give to younger people is, you know, be bold. Be bold. Don't let, well, again, that thing of don't let the possibility of looking foolish or stupid or it being a mistake, don't let that stand in your way. You know, be willing to make that risk.
That's now, right. Shakespeare.
Mm.
Inspired by all the world of stage and all the men and women merely players, we're going to talk about legacy finally. So, Mike Fenton Stevens, how, when all is said and done, would you most like to be remembered?
Well, I could nick a joke from someone else. I'm not afraid of nicking jokes. I could steal a line, but I will credit David Frost with this brilliant line, which is when he was asked how we'd like to be remembered, he said, forever. Which I think, what would you like to be remembered for? And he said, ever.
Lovely.
Which is very good, isn't it? Yeah. So that, but I think I'd like to be remembered as somebody who made people happier. That would be nice. It would be nice if people said, oh, it was fun to be with Mike. I always had a good time with Mike. That was good. He was a nice person. I'm happy to be just nice. That would be good. Although, you know, in the end, we're all forgotten. But if you can, as you say, legacy, if you pass it on to someone else, they pass it on to someone else. That's how you live forever. That's how we have eternal life, I think, is that we pass these things down the generations. And our influence can be felt like a ripple on a pond for many, many years to come. And for many generations that you will, if we all aim to make ourselves better and therefore other people better, we will all become better, and eventually we'll all be good, which would be nice, you know. But I'm only really worried. I've said to my children that I do want to be buried. I want a gravestone, and I want on it. And I said, this is not cheap, but I'll make sure the money's left aside to pay for it. I want the engraving, beneath this sod, Mike's body is laid. If you hear knocking, run and get a spade.
Oh,
there you are. That's me rhyming again. But that's what I'd like to have on my gravestone, which I think would be me leaving the legacy of making people laugh. I hope that, you know, 100 years' time, if people scrape the moss off my tombstone, yes, as it's laid against a wall because nobody remembers where it came from, and they read that, people would say, oh, that's funny.
And because of the joys of reincorporation, just say that again, the epitaph on the gravestone.
Beneath this sod, Mike's body is laid. If you hear knocking, run and get a spade.
And to borrow a line from Hamlet that we all love, the rest is silence. Marvellous. Where can we find out more about you and your wonderful podcast, My Time Capsule, on the hinterweb?
Well, I would say just put in My Time Capsule and search it, and it'll come up. but I'm all over Twitter and Instagram and things. So do come along, come and, you know, join in. And I'm quite happy to have conversations with people on it. People are always surprised when they write things and I reply and they go, is that you? And I say, yeah, who else would it be? You've sent me a message. I'm replying.
And thank you. I've been a direct beneficiary of that wonderfully generous imperative. Thank you. As this has been your moment in the sunshine, is there anything else you'd like to say, Mike Fenton Stevens?
No, I'd like to say, I think something that we may have missed, which is the quote, which I've always been inspired by this quote. It was written by Geoffrey Perkins, who was one of my dearest friends, and sadly died suddenly from sudden death syndrome, it was called. His heart just stopped, which, you know, if we're lucky, that's the way we all go. It was something we used to say at the end of almost every show we did. And it's always been, it's always had an enormous resonance with me. And the quote is, be good to yourself, look out for others, and never forget, an owl in a sack troubles no man. Beautiful, isn't it?
You've been listening to the Good Listening To show here on UK Health Radio with me, Chris Grimes. Oh, it's my son.
If you've enjoyed the show, then please do tune in next week to listen to more stories from The Clearing.
If you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, then please do so. There's also a dedicated Facebook group for the show too. You can contact me about the programme, or if you'd be interested in experiencing some personal impact coaching with me, care of my Level Up Your Impact programme, that's chris@secondcurve.uk. On Twitter and Instagram, it's
@thatchrisgrimes.
So until next time, from me, Chris Grimes, from UK Health Radio, and from Stan,
to your good health.
Goodbye. Mike Fenton Stevens, we've just been here enjoying a conversation together in the Good Listening To show. Could I just get your immediate feedback? What was that like for you being given a Good Listening To in this context?
Well, it's lovely to be listened to, isn't it? Who wouldn't want to be listened to? Too many people spend their life shouting into the darkness. And so I'm delighted to have somebody. Thank you very much, Chris. It's enormous fun. It's great to talk to you.